Welcome to the May 1st, 2008, meeting of the Harbor Advisory Board. Let the record reflect that all members of the Harbor Advisory Board are present. I might mention, too, for the viewing audience, that Trudy O'Brien has found it necessary to resign her position on the Harbor Advisory Board for personal reasons. So we are all here now and accounted for. Has everyone had an opportunity to take a look at the minutes of the last meeting? Are there any changes or corrections? Gene?
Yeah, one small one under 4-4 Harbor Office Project Update. I had stated that I believe that the police department and the fire department were essential facilities, and I was just questioning. I didn't say whether the Harbor Department should be. I just questioned whether they were an essential facility. Where it says...
What paragraph?
Bottom paragraph. Mr. Dowdy said that the fire department, police department are essential facilities, and the Harbor Department should be also. I didn't say should.
Oh. So we scratch should and it would be...
Yeah, accurate. I already talked to Sue, and so she'll pick it up.
Okay. Are there any other corrections or changes? Hearing none, is there a motion to accept the minutes of the last meeting as corrected?
I'll move to accept the minutes as corrected.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, moved by Bill and seconded by Gene Dowdy to accept the minutes of the last meeting as corrected. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes are accepted. He's had a busy last couple of days, so. At this point on the agenda, the board is open for oral communication. If there's anyone in the audience that wishes to address the board on a issue or for a reason that is not stipulated in the agenda, they can come forward now. Hand that to Bill. Seeing none, we'll move right along. We have a presentation today by Trove and Sari Hesseland, who are with the Central Coast Salmon Enhancement Group, and they're going to make a presentation. If you'll step to the microphone, please, and state your name for the record. And
all right. Hi, thanks for having us. I'm Sarah Paddock. I'm the Executive Director with Central Coast Salmon Enhancement. Again, thanks for letting us come out and share a little bit about our organization, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about what's happening not only with salmon season, but with us in particular, the effect it's had on us. You may or may not know, this is our 25th anniversary as an organization. We're pretty excited to have been here for 25 years, working to restore local fisheries. Our organization was founded by local commercial and recreational fishermen who are hoping to do some good work to ensure that salmon fishing was going to be around for generations to come. And like I think probably everyone in this room can imagine, we're really feeling the blow of not having a salmon season this year. The organization, in the founding process, the first program that we started was a pen rearing project, and the goal of that program is to bring salmon to the Central Coast, to acclimate them to our waters, to raise them for a while, get them a little bigger, and release them into the ocean in hopes that they will forage, grow, become beautiful large salmon to be caught by commercial and recreational fishermen. That's the program that's 25 years old. As the organization has grown, we recognize that stock enhancement wasn't really enough. It wasn't going to, it's kind of a Band-Aid on a, what obviously is a huge problem for the West Coast. And so we looked for other ways that we could be involved and make a difference in salmonid fisheries, not just salmon, but also in the steelhead trout that live here in our local creeks. And so the organization has grown to include watershed projects, which are community-driven, volunteer-based programs that bring people who live on, work on, own land on, farm on, are concerned with our creek systems and our fisheries, brings them together to evaluate the health of our creeks, and then to prioritize projects that could be happen to improve those creek systems, both for fish habitat, but also for human habitat as well, so that they're healthy for us, the water quality is good, the water quantity is what we need. Like I said, the habitat for the fish is there, can deal with floodplain issues, all of that big picture that ultimately serves both human and fish resources here. And we also recognize that it's great to do this work, but you need for people to know about it. You need to share that message. You need to get the public involved and committed to it. And so we run a pretty large education and outreach program. The highlight of that program is a Trout in the Classroom program. We place incubator aquariums in classrooms, and we deliver trout eggs to the students. They hatch them out. They raise them. We take them on field trips to release them. All the while, we're in the classrooms doing presentations. We provide teachers with curriculum, and the students are getting an opportunity to learn about the life cycle of these fish and the things that are happening in the habitat and the limiting factors for the fish, and also just to develop an emotional bond with the environment and become engaged with the great outdoors, which a lot of kids don't get to do anymore. That program continues to be strong. We have classrooms from North County all the way into northern Santa Barbara County. About 5,000 students participate each year in it. It's a neat program. From that, we're really excited to announce that this year we have moved into a new facility and we're developing a hands-on lab that students from around the county can come to visit, both through their classrooms or through after-school clubs. It'll be a place where the community can come to and learn about not just fisheries but also watershed issues and things that you can do in your personal life and in the big picture to contribute to helping what's happening with salmon. Speaking of, I'm going to introduce our board president, Thorv Hesselin. I don't know if you want to join me. Speaking of salmon season, as you all know, 2008, salmon season has been closed. The populations that returned to the rivers in California were as low as 80% less than they were 5 years ago. And so while that has had a huge direct impact for our commercial and recreational fishermen, it also had a huge direct impact for us. Historically, our fish that we use to raise and release in our pin ring project come from the McCollumy hatchery. That hatchery this year, their returns were so low, they were not able to do 50% of their own mitigation projects, much less provide fish for any of the cooperative pin ring projects. So our project and every other pin ring project throughout the West Coast has been shut down for the year. One less batch of fish that are going to be going into the ocean. So it's pretty devastating for us. If you had anything, Linda.
Would you take a question at this point, or do you want to wait till the end?
I was going to let Thorv say something, but if you want
to... Well, let him go ahead.
I'm open.
Well, I'll just take a couple of minutes. Okay. Once Sarah gets going, I don't get a word in edgeways anyway. She can talk really fast and say a lot in a short period of time. But I've been mostly involved as the board president. You're sort of the head volunteer with the pen rearing program. And the bottom line, of course, is that we're trying to figure out what to do with those pens in the future. And these pens are, about 46 feet by 22 feet. And we've got two of them that we've taken apart. And when they washed up on the beach at Avila, and we've got two more that are needing repairs right now, and we're in the process of probably just going to leave them in dry dock and try and repair them and see what happens in the years to come. But we are committed to keeping those pens, even though stock enhancement, where fish and game is going to go and where pen rearing is going to go over the next couple of years, we're not sure. But we're not going to dismantle the two remaining pens that we had left. They got washed up on Fisherman's Beach at the beginning of January, had to get a crane down there to lift them off, and so I've sort of been dealing with the nuts and bolts with that and reaching out with the fishing community to see where we go with the pen rearing program in the future. And that's where I had the conversation with Rick and with Mark and some others in the area, fishermen in the area, and that's why we're reaching out to Morro Bay just to sort of tell our story. So we'll see where it goes, but we're going to hang in there with a pin rearing program. But Sarah paints the big picture about what Al Salmon Enhancement is doing. So that's about what I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Go ahead. And I have a question about, you said that 80% less returns to the river systems?
On some of the river systems, yeah. The returns were 80% lower than they were 5 years ago.
Do they have any idea why?
That's the biggest challenge that we're facing. You know, a lot of times when you have an environmental disaster like this year has been, you usually have something you can point your finger at. Right now, there's not one particular thing. A lot of the freshwater managers are pointing at the ocean water, and ocean water managers are pointing their fingers at the freshwater.
Did you ever hear of salmon that didn't return in 3 to 4 years? They waited to 5 years?
I don't know if they'll do that or not, if salmon can do that or not. I couldn't answer that. It's a biology question that
I'm just curious, because I know that there are sometimes when you catch an extra big fish, he'd been out in the ocean a year longer.
And that there is that possibility. One of the overwhelming opinions that NOAA is putting out right now is that in 2005 there was a lack of an upwell in the ocean, which diminished the feed supply for those juvenile fish that were hitting the ocean that year. And so their hope is that this is a one-year occurrence. But if you look over, 150 years worth of data, there are up and down years, but the overwhelming trend is that salmon are in a decline, and that hasn't changed. And so there's definite concern that this is something that's going to continue, but there is a possibility that next year we'll see a big bounce back. But it is harder not being able to isolate and pinpoint a specific occurrence or a specific thing. It means that, fisheries on a whole, we're not sure what to tackle. There's so much going on. Because certainly the ocean water quality and the lack of that upwell, the changing water temperatures, the changing currents, that's definitely affecting the salmon populations. But so are the dams in our rivers, the river quality, the pesticides that are getting into it, that's contributing as well.
One more question. Before you keep going on.
It's tough. You just got to throw something
question.
At me.
compared to 25, 30 years ago, how many hatcheries did they have then and how many hatcheries do they have now?
Ooh, I do not know that question. But you're right to assume that they are declining. There are definitely fewer hatcheries now.
There used to be a lot of hatcheries, and they used to hatch a lot of fish.
Well, there's a lot of science being released on hatcheries. And that's one of our concerns for our pin rearing project is depending on how the Fish and Game and NOAA decide to develop in terms of hatcheries can really affect whether or not pin rearing will be allowed to happen in the future. Some of the research coming out is showing that the more hatchery fish you have, the less healthy your wild population is going to be.
Monk.
Yeah, well, I'm on the other hand, this was the other piece of it. On the other hand, I also saw something that said 90% of the fish being caught are of hatchery origin and aren't wild origin. And
well, they take the fish out of the river and they hatch the eggs and they put them back in the river. All you did was just take over the time that those eggs were growing.
Yeah.
To me,
well, and
it's fine.
And there seem to be kind of two camps of belief there, and a lot of research and money is being thrown into figuring out which way to swing. And I'm not the expert. I can't say which way it's going to go, but I know that when I'm at meetings and I'm at conferences and I listen to people from Fish and Game talk, it feels like right now that organization is moving towards not having hatcheries and concentrating on habitat restoration to ensure wild populations.
That would be fine if they got rid of the dams. That's
but, yeah, and that's the other piece of it is if they don't have habitat and they have big dams and they're not going to survive, and we're going to look at I heard one expert talk about salmon becoming a boutique fishery, that they would never be extinct. They'd be similar to buffalo and bison, and they would be there, but they would never be a thriving industry again, which is just I find shocking and frightening, and I can't imagine just sitting idly by and allowing that to happen. So you kind of have to assume that some fish are better than no fish, and if 90% of the fish being caught are hatchery fish and have been through programs like our pin rearing project, if you get rid of those, that means 90% of the fish aren't out there, presumably. So it's scary, but there are a lot of people battling it. There's a lot of science, a lot of new studies about to come out. And where they swing, I'm not sure where it's going to go. It does depend on how you vote. Depends on where you're supporting and how you're voting, absolutely.
Lynn, do you have any questions?
So there hasn't really been anything that says that the hatcheries are aiding the population?
I'm trying really hard not to give you misinformation, but from what I've read and the experts that I've listened to at lectures, what they do say is that while 90% of the fish may be hatchery fish, for every hatchery fish that's put out there, there's an inverse effect on wild populations. So the more hatchery fish you put out, the less healthy the wild populations are. It's data they're still currently collecting right now.
But when you say less healthy the wild population, does that mean that the fish themselves are not very healthy?
No, the fish... The wild,
not as many,
that there's not as many
not
of it. Because the other piece of the puzzle is that when they study the actual physical health of the fish, a study I saw 2 months ago said that the first generation, for every generation that a fish is hatched not in a wild origin, they're hatched in some sort of hatchery program, they're 30% less fit as a fish. But I am so not an expert, and so I don't know how they gauge that and what effect that has. But it does make you stand back and wonder how we're going to approach it.
Are you doing any good?
Yeah, well, and I think we are doing good with those fish because we're ensuring that there are fish out there to be caught. I think probably what will happen is we'll look for even better, more effective ways to support that wild population. But it's up in the air. The science is very new. There's not a whole lot known, and most premier experts are struggling with what the solution is going to be to the salmon seasons.
Thank you.
Bill? How are you funded right now, and how is your continued funding going to be within the salmon crisis right now?
Well, it depends on what piece of the puzzle you look at. We're funded through a couple of different resources, and we obviously apply for grants. We've got quite a few fish and game grants that we work on. We have a strong membership base. We have fundraisers, annual dinners, donations, those kinds of things that help get us through. The education program I spoke of earlier and the watershed program that I spoke of as well, those are very strong programs. We've been really good about getting grant funding. This county has some incredible nonprofits doing restoration work, and we've worked really hard to bring money that concentrates. Historically, a lot of the money from Fish and Game is concentrated on Northern California, and they've ignored the steelhead habitat of this area. But we've done a really good job with our watershed management plans of showing that we have problems that need to be fixed, and we've been able to draw a lot of money into this community through grants. So those programs are actually pretty well supported. The pin rearing program, on the other hand, not only did we face having no fish, but we also face having no money. Historically, we've gotten funding through a large portion of our funding has been through the Salmon Stamp Program. I'm assuming you all know that, that's funded through the commercial fishermen stamps that they buy, and there's not going to be very many commercial fishermen, so there aren't going to be very many funds there. So even if we do see that project up and running next year, it's going to take some serious fundraising on our parts and some really hard work to bring that money to make that program happen.
Michelle?
I don't have any questions about the program, but thanks for bringing all the information here. And I do have a question. I don't know if you know the answer to it, but I haven't been able to find out why the Water Quality Control Board moved the CMC hearing to September.
I don't know why. I'll ask around, though. If I find out anything, I'll let you know.
Gene?
What shape are the pens in right now?
The pens are, we've got two that are in fairly decent shape, except for the supports for the bird netting have been pretty bashed up, and so we need some specialist in extruder welding to weld the plastic that's busted up in the supports, and that's the best estimate we got so far. It started at $12,000. We said, what? So then we got another estimate, and we're standing at about $5,500 right now. We can get volunteers to do the the hammer work, the hard, but that specialty welding for those supports, the way they were built, it looks like we need some specialty welding like an extruder machine. So we're trying to ramp that down to see if we can find another way to do it with cost less, but that's where we're at.
Okay, thank you. Uh-huh. My next question is, how healthy is San Luis Creek right now, and could it receive smolts or salmon eggs?
The likelihood of anyone allowing you to put salmon eggs in there is pretty slim. It's a steelhead habitat, and our county, our rivers that are in our creeks that contain steelhead, they're listed on the threatened species list. And so what happens in those creeks is pretty strictly monitored by Department of Fish and Game. So they probably wouldn't allow us to do any sort of stock enhancement with Chinook salmon. They're not actually native to our creek systems. They're only found in our ocean here.
The reason I asked that is several years ago, my oldest son was a fish counter in the creek there. Mm-hmm. And he showed us photos after photos after photos of huge salmon there. Mm-hmm. So the salmon do go up there.
They do go up there. Oh, yeah. They will end up in that creek system, and they do sneak in there every once in a while. And the good news is that creek is healthy enough for a salmon to go in,
yeah,
which is great.
And the homeless people were just having salmon barbecues every night?
If only it was full of them all the time. And, you know, this year we got lots of photos of people who had seen steelhead trout spawning and moving upstream in San Luis Obispo Creek and in Arroyo Grande Creek. And, in fact, just probably 4 weeks ago, we had a survey crew out, and they captured a few juvenile steelhead in the creek as well. So our creeks, they're capable of supporting those fish. There's definitely projects in each of the creek systems that need to happen to better the habitat for fish, but they're not.
But they wouldn't allow salmon then? Okay.
I can't imagine Department of Fish and Game at this point. I mean, you never know what the future of politics is going to see, but at this point, I don't think that they would allow any kind of stock enhancement program of that kind in that creek.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ed?
One more. This is for the fellow there. And the water quality in Avila, is that better than Morro Bay for your project?
Oh, that would be for our biologist.
Yeah. I don't know that that's ever been I don't know if it's ever been researched.
And we used to keep anchovies in receivers over by Target Rock. Virgil used to have several receivers there, in addition to the ones he's got down there now. They were moved years ago, but I don't know if he was made to move them or what the deal was there. But it seemed like the bait seemed to live pretty good. But the difference would be instead of having the violent storms that Avila has, from you're a little protected in the bay here.
For sure. It's a south swell that
gets. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. I understand the weather conditions. I know why. I just was wondering if that might be a consideration for Morro Bay. I don't know if.
I don't think we've ever talked about it, but it certainly
you might
fair.
Ask.
Yeah. Fair conversation.
That's it.
Yeah. Good point.
Well, if I might offer a comment, too, and then we'll let you finish if you'd like. I also appreciate you coming, Thorb and Sarah. And, Sarah, you obviously know a lot about this.
I do not feel like I know much at all, but thank you.
I've always been impressed with the organization, and I hope that you continue. And I know you're working for the good of the fisheries, and I very much appreciate it. Please keep us advised. And if there's something we can do to help, we'll always be willing to consider it. I've had people approach me before about the idea of salmon pens or something like that here, and I always figured, well, you must be meeting your needs in Port San Luis. So, and obviously now you've got a whole other challenge to deal with, so I'll just leave it at that. But thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Let me ask just one question also, and before we finish here. You mentioned that you're out of the pen rearing business for this year and closed down for the year. Does that mean you won't start back up next year, or?
Oh, by no means.
You just don't know.
We just don't know. Our definite hope is that we will start up next year, and we're looking for how we can make that happen. It would be ideal if the fall runs were up next year and we were able to receive fish from Fish and Game. Being a cooperative pen rearing project with them means they've supplied those fish to us at no cost. And so if they're not able to supply those fish, then not only do we face the financial burden of improving those pens, making sure they're operational, of making sure we have feed supplies, hard cost supplies. We would then also have to incur the cost of finding fish and finding out whether or not Fish and Game would permit us to have those fish trucked in. So, but we're doing that, and Thorf has been amazing at keeping track of that, and we have quite a team of volunteers and staff that are trying to find out, is there a way we can make this happen, and are there other things that we could do to help salmon well into the future? And it's a big question mark, but we hope that the pen rearing project will help happen next year.
Ed here could probably answer this question for me easily enough, but is the salmon season closed to commercial and recreational fishing for the entire West Coast, or is it still open in Washington or off the coast of Washington?
My understanding, it's the entire West Coast.
Oregon to Washington.
Oregon to Washington.
Oh, okay. And the part of that is whether it's nearshore or offshore, whether it's federally regulated or state regulated, too, at least as far as California is concerned. I guess that's true of Oregon and Washington as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I wanted to thank you both, too, for coming. We've enjoyed having little presentations on the fishery experience here and from the commercial fishermen as well in the past, and we thoroughly enjoyed, I did, and the board did, I'm sure, your presentation tonight. I want to apologize if I misspoke. I think I introduced you as husband and wife. I don't know where I got that, but I've got it written down here. If it's true, good. If not, I apologize. I apologize for stating
that. We spend a lot of time together, but it's not true.
She's younger than my youngest daughter. So.
Okay, well, somewhere along the line, I got that information wrong and held it right up till tonight, so I apologize.
I've been accused
to that.
Of worse things than that. I'll live with it.
Okay. But thank you very much for your presentation and for taking the time to come speak to us and to the viewing public out there.
Yeah, thanks for letting us. It was great to be here.
Okay, thank you. Our next presentation is by Mr. Dimitri. I take it the two young men with you, are they with you, or are you guys in the audience?
Both. They're in the audience, but they're friends of mine.
Okay.
Let me make, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, I'll make a quick introduction to Dimitri before he has to launch in his program.
Please do.
Dimitri Duraki is a just about finished mechanical engineering student at Cal Poly. I think he's in his last quarter. He also works for us as one of our co-lifeguard supervisors. He's been a beach lifeguard for the city of Morro Bay for 4 years now, Dimitri. Been a great employee for us, and he also, when we first started looking at this, he came in the office and started saying, gee, I'm really interested in this. And so I figured, well, we'll use you then. So Dimitri has an interesting story to tell about how he gained some of this information, and I think also is going to really give you some information on the technology and some of the bigger macro information on what's going on with wave energy. Then we'll have to talk a little bit more about this proposal locally. So this is Dimitri Duraki.
Hi, guys. I want to apologize in advance. I had some pretty severe technical difficulties trying to interface between the Macintosh and the PC here. So I lost most of my good graphics, unfortunately. In the last 10 minutes, I got about half of them from my computer transferred over, but they're not all there. I do have a handout here. You guys can pass around. I got this actually in New York City. Like I was saying, I got that and a lot of this information in this presentation from a conference I attended weekend before last in New York City. I got a grant from the General Engineering Department at Cal Poly to go and do that, so it was cool. Rick said, I just, you know, as an engineer and a surfer and someone who loves the ocean, I have a lot of interest in the subject. And I'm planning on maybe doing a senior project in some related field sometime soon. So I'm going to just share the information that I have. It's by no means complete in all aspects, but what I wanted to cover was basically just an overview of current technologies and some projects that are out there right now. The resource potential that the ocean energy field offers, and a little bit of the federal permitting process, which is actually probably the most difficult aspect of the whole thing to understand. I'll go ahead and get started with the current technology here. The two that are probably most relevant to us here in California, and especially in Morro Bay, are the wave energy converters, which in the industry they call those WECs, and possibly tidal or ocean current turbines. There's lots of other ways to harness ocean energy, but not quite relevant to here. Just to be familiar with the names OTEC, that's ocean thermal energy conversion. Blue energy, people have been starting to talk about. That's creating energy between the salinity gradients in water. Then there's offshore wind, and there's even marine biomass, but I'll go into a little more detail about those first two. The wave energy converters, there's literally hundreds of designs right now out there being tested by different people. The industry hasn't really decided or converged on one design as being dominant or the best, but they all can kind of fall into three categories. A terminator type category, I'll explain these in a minute, but point absorbers and attenuators. This is just some pictures. I had much better ones 20 minutes ago before I came here on my computer, but I was able to find these at the last moment. On the lower left, that's a Palamis. That's that sausage-shaped device you may have seen. That's an attenuator. Above that are some point absorber buoys. To the right, those are both examples of terminators type of devices. I lost this picture here, but the attenuator is basically a long, cylindrical, floating object. It's about 150 meters long is the ones they're making now, this company called Palamis. How it works is it's segmented, and as waves articulate it horizontally and vertically as it passes over swells, it has hydraulic pistons that are basically extended and contracted, and they run hydraulic pumps, which are attached to electricity generators inside the tube. They have deployed them in Portugal and in the UK just on a prototype basis. Let's see, I went a little far here. The second probably most common device out there is the point absorber buoy. A company named Finavira is the premier designer of this type, and it's basically a buoy. You can see what's underneath it in the right hand picture, and it's a pump. It's a two-stage pump that pumps seawater up into the buoy through basically a water wheel, a Pelton wheel, and it has a generator inside it, and there's a cable that goes to the down to the ocean floor, and then that's how the power gets to shore. So they've actually, the Federal Energy Regulatory Committee, FERC, has actually permitted four of those point absorber Finavira buoys off the Washington coastline in Macaw Bay. So I'll go into that a little bit later with the permitting process, but they're also in the water deployed and have been proven to actually create electricity. See here. Oh, okay. Here's a picture of that terminator. This is called the Wave Dragon. It's basically a big scoop where waves slosh into a confined space up onto a raised platform, and then the water falls through the middle and turns a turbine on its way. So this one is only a 1 to 4.5 scale in this picture. And you can see it's quite large. It's only a 20 kilowatt device. So 20 kilowatts is about a 20th of a megawatt, which is the scale that those point absorbers and the attenuators run at. So for a much bigger device, a much lower efficiency, probably won't last as long as a good design. Another area that's getting a lot of attention right now is the tidal and ocean current turbines. They basically all are based on some type of submerged turbine or wheel, kind of like an underwater windmill. They also, a lot of times, need to accommodate flow reversal, like in a channel way where the tidal current, you know, has its ebb and flow. In New York's East River, this was a part of the conference that I attended. They had a demonstration presentation from this project, and there's six turbines in the East River right now. They power a nearby supermarket and a parking garage, and this is a FERC-permitted project. Actually, they created their own type of permit. It was a precedent that I'll go into later, but Vernant Power, it's a company, installed these six tidal turbines, and they've been operating for about a year nonstop, and they have a fixed pitch rotor, and they actually spin underwater by themselves with the switch of the tide. So the resource potential is pretty large. Worldwide, we're looking at about 2 terawatts, which is 10 to the 12 watts, which is quite a lot of energy potential. Worldwide, the electricity demand is only about 3.5 terawatts, so we're looking at more than half of the world's electricity possibly contained in the ocean. That's at about a 15% extraction rate, so that's a relatively low efficiency. In California, just in February of 2008, the California Energy Commission completed a study to look at California's wave energy potential. And they looked at 50 years of wave data in 1 degree of latitude increments. They broke down the coast. So their results were pretty interesting. The top 3 sites in California for wave energy conversion was identified as Point Sur, Eureka, and Point Arguello. So they also recommended placement at about 90 meters of water, and they pretty much ruled out areas south of Point Conception for grid connection, but leaving a possibility for desalination or maybe other uses. So nationwide, the majority of our wave energy potential is actually in Alaska and Hawaii, 75%. So that doesn't leave too much for the rest of the continental United States. But altogether, we're looking at about 252 terawatts per year at that same 15% extraction. So ocean current is significantly less, 35 to 75, and tidal even lower than that. But about 0.4 of a terawatt per year, terawatt hours per year in California. So I'll touch a little bit on the federal permitting. This is probably the trickiest part, as I said earlier, about the whole industry. There's 2 agencies that are right now kind of dueling out the authority for permitting wave energy projects. Those are the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the Mineral Management Services. So I can kind of go through both. FERC basically has 4 different permits that they're offering hydrokinetic applicants, people who are coming to them with designs. And hydrokinetic meaning moving water, so we're talking about, again, the wave energy converters and tidal or ocean current type things. So they have this preliminary permit, which you guys are probably aware of with Green Wave and and lots of other projects in California. There's test projects, which applies to that Verdant power installation in New York. And then the pilot, there's a pilot project lease, and then there's standard license. The preliminary permit maintains priority of the applicant once it's issued for 3 years. And in those 3 years, they can't construct anything. They're allowed feasibility studies and to get their pre-filing work done. They're given priority after that time for a license. Now, as of April 9th of this year, so just a few weeks ago, they had already issued 7 wave preliminary permits, 32 tidal and 65 inland waterway permits nationally. And they still have 6 pending, 3 more current, 11 tidal, and some 32 inland waterways. What's that? I'm pretty sure that one's pending.
It's, I believe, one of the still pending ones.
I don't know too much about that, but I think it's pending. So here's just some more from FERC, how much they've issued and how much they're pending. It says here 350 to 510 issued megawatts. And like I said earlier, those buoys run about 1 megawatt per buoy. So just to give you an idea of about how many buoys they're anticipating permitting. I mean, they haven't allowed any construction yet, but those are that's the scale of magnitude they're talking about. Well, megawatts, the power rating, it's 1 million watts. Well, a megawatt hour is over an hour. Like, you're charged at your meter kilowatt hours, so that's 1 kilowatt over an hour's time. So a megawatt of wave energy, it's just a power rating, and then the power rate would be the megawatt hour. That would be, you know, a megawatt buoy operating for an hour's time.
Mr. Chairman, I think you might be asking, maybe, I think the answer to your question is it depends on the size of the facility, how much electricity they can generate. So a larger facility, obviously, but on one single installation is probably a fairly small generator. I think that's what he's trying to get to.
Well, yeah, it's the... That's what it's rated as. Like, the Morro Bay Power Plant, I think, is 1,002 megawatts is what it's rated at. So we're talking, you know, a thousandth of the Morro Bay Power Plant per buoy, basically.
Okay.
So FERC has had a lot of applications for this preliminary permit. At the conference, there was a representative there, and they had this new policy they called strict scrutiny. And what they were trying to do is weed out people who are possibly prospecting sites, applying for a preliminary permit in hopes of just having, some value added in having the priority to apply for a license in the future. So what they... proposed to remedy this is these new requirements. They have to have an appropriately sized area. They want better details of the proposed technology. They need a schedule of activities and semi-annual progress reports. That's for the 3-year period. And then they're threatening to cancel permits if there's not progress. So they're hoping to prevent that to some extent. The test projects don't even need a FERC license. That's since 2005, after Verdant Power put those tidal turbines in New York. This is for experimental technologies, short-term installations, testing new ideas, and not transmitting any electricity. So this is just to test new devices. And that's available.
Excuse me, is there any facility operating right now off the coast of, off the western coast of the United States?
Is there any...
Facility, is there any...
Aren't those Macaw Bay They are in place,
those,
I believe.
Those have been licensed but not deployed yet. There was one in Oregon, a single buoy that I think was under this test, the test project status, and it was out for 3 months or so. But I think it's done. I don't think at this time there's any wave energy converters on the West Coast. But there are a few test sites in the works, different places around the country. There's one in Puget Sound that they're working on, where it would be a permitted area for companies to bring their devices just to test. And so the permitting process would already be done to a specific site. But that's also in the works. I don't think that's established yet.
The permit and the license are two different things, and the permitting process goes first.
Yeah.
If they issue the permit, then the next step is a license, unless they're excluded from it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the preliminary permit comes first. That's good for 3 years. Afterwards, they can go through the licensing process, which is their standard license process that they use for any hydropower installation, except they've created what they call a conditioned license, which is just for hydrokinetic projects in the ocean. It has the same, they weren't too clear about this, but I believe it has the same procedures for application as a standard license, which would authorize construction and operation. And they are good for 50 years for the first license, and after that they can relicense for somewhere between 30 to 50 years. So, let's see here. Okay, so the other agency that's claiming authority to regulate these installations are the Marine Mineral Management Service. And the Energy Policy Act gives explicit authority to the MMS to grant lease or create easements for right-of-ways for alternative energy uses in the federal outer continental shelf, which is 3 nautical miles out to 100 nautical miles out, I believe. They're going about the permitting process in a little different way. Instead of granting preliminary permits, they're advertising these limited site leases. Basically, what they've done is they've broken their outer continental shelf area into different cells. Then they advertise each cell to see if there's interest for people to deploy or for companies to deploy their device. And it's really just for data collection and testing only. It's a 5-year lease, but there's no priority afterwards towards a permit. And it excludes offshore wind production. And it's had 45 nominations already made, or proposed leases already nominated in California, Oregon, and Washington. And they plan to start issuing those leases this year. So I had a map on here of where those were. I lost it. But from what I can tell, these lease sites are offshore of Eureka and Fort Bragg. There's a concentration of about 10 lease cells. That's their unit that they're using for the lease, off of Eureka, and about the same off Fort Bragg, in California at least. But 45 nationally. They are undergoing an environmental study plan. It's a committee-reviewed environmental study sponsored by the MMS, and they're collecting bird data. They're doing EMF transmission line impact studies on, I guess, different marine species and sharks. They're looking at visual impacts and trying to study the pile driving effects. So, as a conclusion, really, ocean energy is still just an emerging technology. It's at least 3 to 5 years away from a production level. This is for several reasons. There's really a lack of investment capital. The U.S. government invests substantially less than other countries. Last year, we, invested about $3 million or something like that. That's about what New Zealand invested in ocean energy. Ireland invested 9 times that. So the lack of government support, along with the kind of uncertainty in the regulation as far as who's going to take control, MMS or FERC, kind of makes investors, uneasy. And so at least in the U.S., it's really progressing slowly, and we seem to be at least 3 to 5 years from seeing anything on a production level. And that's all I had.
Okay, are you...
Question slide.
Are you willing to field some questions?
Sure, yeah, as best
okay.
I can.
Let me start down on this end this time with Gene.
Let's see. Do you know whether there are any offshore lease sites from the Mineral Management Department for off of this coast right here?
I don't think so. The map that they provided at the conference was basically from Eureka to Fort Bragg, and it showed two clusters, one off of Eureka and one off of Fort Bragg. And, you know, they haven't really publicized any other sites. So,
my next question is, did you read the articles that were in our staff report from up in Northern California, or Oregon, excuse me? And I guess the overriding concern I have is the local people seem to have been excluded from any decision-making at all.
Yeah, and that was actually a hot topic at the conference, and the FERC representative took a lot of flack on that one. Internationally, the most successful projects, that one in Portugal, and the ones they've had in the UK, have been really community-based and had a lot of local involvement. FERC doesn't seem to have so far gone that route. And I think, you know, like that article, that, you know, that reaction is already, negative reaction is already, you know, starting, so...
Michelle?
Kind of the same question Gene just had. I read, and I don't think it was any of this, but something else that said that part of their permitting process was going to include like green wave energy to work with local agencies and basically like stakeholder groups.
Right.
Do you know anything about that?
I don't know too much about that. I myself have tried to look into GreenWave a little bit and haven't had much luck. You know, on the local level, I'm not too sure what their involvement is. And, you know, I really couldn't tell you. Rick, do you have anything on that?
And I think that's one of the key questions is when would the city be invited, the city, county of San Luis Obispo, state of California, be invited to comment in and potentially participate. We learned about this green wave energy. I think it's a pilot project, is that right? No, it's a...
They're applying for a preliminary permit with FERC.
Thank you, excuse me. So it's a preliminary permit application. We learned about it by receiving a copy electronically from a friend who was reviewing it at the federal level in the National Marine Fisheries Service. So there was no, you know, if we hadn't got sent that just as a thought by that person, we wouldn't have been aware of that application even being made. FERC has no notification process, as far as I know, for any local agency. I don't know about the state. Then the big question becomes, too, is what would happen if they're granted this preliminary permit in the 3 years? One would assume that they would have to develop designs, reach out to the communities, then explore for certainly in state waters. There would have to be some sort of state water permitting process and a lease from the State Lands Commission at a minimum. But it's very hard to know or to tell exactly what that might be. And I just want to say at this point,
transmission lines, electrical lines over the top of those phone cables that are already there. There's 11 phone cables coming out of there. So I think it would be our best advantage to maybe get a hold of a federal representative and write some kind of a letter to Green Wave and to FERC and to Minerals Management Service and maybe suggest that we're not against Green Wave Energy or anything they want to do, but they ought to place it down off Diablo Canyon because there's already a two-mile area around Diablo Canyon where we can't fish, number one. And they got an MPA that goes out 3 miles there, and they have the electrical transmission lines that transmit the energy, you know, inland, and wouldn't have the problem with the phone cables, and it would solve a lot of problems for local fisheries. So that's my only advice, that we nip it in the bud early and see if we can't get a letter of some kind drafted. Thank you.
Bill?
No questions now. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Sure, you're welcome.
Lynn?
Not a question, but a comment. I Googled this Green Wave Energy, and it came up only on YouTube, but it's based down in Southern California someplace. I can't remember exactly where. And it showed the tube that they use, this pump thing that they want to put out there on the internet. So you could get an idea of what it's supposed to look like. And this big bed that they have floating, apparently floating on top of the water. I don't know if it's on top or underneath. But the amount of area that they want for that, 17 square miles from Bouchon to Morro Bay, is substantial. But anyway, I guess you could even write a letter right to the company if you really wanted to. Tell them to.
Pay them a visit.
You could pay them a visit. They aren't that far away.
You know, if I might, can I try a question on Dimitri and see if you know? I'm not sure. From reading their relatively brief application, which I think we did include in your packet, or at least part of it, one of your previous packets to FERC, it wasn't clear to me that they've determined what technology they would use. It seemed like almost they were asking for the area and said they would develop a technology or submit it with if they were granted the preliminary permit. Would that be your understanding? Or
yeah, as I understand it, actually, what I read was that was one of the reasons that permit has actually been denied or asked for a revision, because for one, they didn't specify which device, and that strict scrutiny, that's a new requirement, is they need to specify which manufacturer of wave energy, what WEC they're going to use, and exactly where they're going to put it. So I think you're right, in the permit it didn't specify any.
And just seeing that information they gained too, I think the Green Wave doesn't appear, to what little we can learn about them, they don't appear to have expertise either in the energy industry or in the wave technology industry, or they appear to be, you know, sort of like a person staking a claim or something like that. So my guess is that one of the reasons they might still be pending is that they're running up against some, they're asked for additional information, but frankly I don't know either. And I think it is kind of, I don't know what's posted on YouTube myself, but I don't know if that's the technology that they would necessarily choose.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Thanks. I have a few questions. One of the comments that I want to make, kind of in support of what you've given us a great deal more detail on, and I handed a copy of this out to the board right at the beginning of the meeting, wasn't able to get it to you earlier, but in the April 16th Sun Bulletin, there's an article about this company from Thousand Oaks that plans to or has started the permit process, and at the backside of that article it shows two of the devices that they are considering, at least I assume are considering. One is the buoy type that you showed in the beginning. The other is the Palamas design. And it also shows a chart of the area that they're talking about wanting to put these devices, one or the other of them. And it is a 17-mile stretch of ocean that exists about a mile offshore from Montano de Oro and runs from Point Bouchon to the South Jetty. And just looking at the pictures provided, either the buoys or the other one, because it appears to me, like Rick mentioned, it's almost like the 1849 gold rush in California, where people are staking out claims to the minerals that exist in the ground or the potential that's there without any oversight or regulations going on. And before we know it, we might have this area out there of 17 square miles of bobbing buoys without much to say about it. So that's one part of it that seems to be of great concern, or should be of great concern to us. That's all the comments I have to make. They're not questions. I want to thank you, too, for your expertise. I think you've provided us more information than anything I've read so far has provided me. And apparently, from some of the things I read, more information than the companies that are applying for the permits are providing for. So I appreciate that. I suspect there's going to be a future in ocean energy, as there is in all non-renewable forms. But I appreciate your expertise and your presentation. Thank you for appearing here.
May I ask a question quickly? Did you hear anything about the intervener process or anything about that when the FERC discussion was going on?
I've just read a little bit, and nothing came up at the conference. But I know that Sonoma County and another county north of there have done that.
I believe that a preliminary permit was issued to PG&E for that project up in Fort Bragg, and I believe.
I think that might have been one of the, yeah, yes. There's five or six permitted wave projects, or preliminary permitted projects, and I think that is one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so, too. And that's I think, that so that project would be a little further along, and that's, you know, and frankly, I don't know enough about to know if there's an intervener process at this point where it's pending or not, or that's something that happens after they issue the permit. That might be a guess, but who knows? Well, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much again for your presentation.
All right, you're welcome. Thanks.
And thank you.
Hopefully you don't go away either for cases. Yeah, you never know. We might, if you've got another 5 or 10 minutes, stick around, and we'll see if we can use you a little more.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just open this issue up for discussion if there's anything that anyone has to say about it.
Sucks.
Well.
There was some kind of a green wave energy system that was established, something that was deployed in I think it was in Coos Bay in Oregon, and it was out there, as I understand, for a short period of time, maybe a couple of months, and then a big storm came along and destroyed it.
Took care of it, huh?
Yep. I don't know if they're going to put it back, but that was a newspaper article that I read.
Anyone else? Gene?
Yes, there was a tidal generator out on Cayucas Pier years and years and years and years ago, and it did the same thing. It got all washed away. It was a wave energy thing, and it just blew away.
What did it power? Did it power anything?
Electricity. I mean, I don't know where electricity went, but...
The new solar compactor they have there now.
Michelle? Anything to add, Ed?
No, I just reiterated what I said before. You know, I don't care what they stick out there, as long as they stick it where it's not going to bother the fishermen and the boaters, and I think they ought to put it down by Diablo Canyon. It's off limits to us. Yeah, let them do it there if they want to. But, you know, it's you wouldn't have to, if you could change their location, their minds about it because of the submarine cables and other issues, we wouldn't have to worry about intervening and all this stuff would be out of our hair. So that's what I think we need to write a letter of some kind to get it started.
What's the interest of the board in regards to this issue? Do you is there any interest in?
I'd rather write a letter.
Well, I appreciate the idea of writing a letter, and I think we probably need to write one. We'd need to figure out who to write it to and what to say in it. But
I would write one to Greenway, then to FERC both, and then to Mid Copy Minerals Management Service, and have somebody to do it in the city's official position. And
microphone. Use your mic.
I'd have one drafted for the Green Wave and for Minerals Management Service and FERC. And if the city doesn't write a letter, I'm sure we can get the association to write one for the Fishermen's Association. But I would hope that this board and maybe the council would see fit to question the area that they're putting it in because it's for the issues that I raised earlier.
Let me ask Dimitri then, maybe you can help with an answer to this question.
And at this point, I'm pretty sure it hasn't been issued. It's still pending.
And on that website, there is a place to address correspondence.
Oh,
whether,
okay.
whether we get a response or not, I'm not sure, but I think there is a place to address comments.
Okay, well, thank you.
Sure.
You know, another area of concern would be in regards to the intervener status. I believe in the emails that I've seen from up north, the county was the intervening party. But I wonder, in our case, if the city would be the intervener, since it's... That's true. It's outside the city limits.
Yeah, that's a good question, too. Whether it would be that, I would say that the city would have an interest, I would think, but it does look like it's outside the city's direct jurisdiction, and the county, state of California, at this time, they're in the state of waters of the state of California also.
So quite possibly then the limits of what we could do as a board would be to advise the city and maybe through that process request that they find out what the county's intent is in regards to the potential of this project.
Yeah, I would say you've got a couple options. Let me give you another piece of information, too, that I heard just pretty current, too, because I was just up in Sacramento as a part of the California Marine Affairs and Navigations Conference. One of the presentations we had was from the Cal EPA Undersecretary for Energy Policy, and it wasn't on this subject, but we were able to ask him a question about what was going to happen with wave energy generation, and his answer was quite interesting, I thought. He basically, and this is not, these are my words, so this is not quoting him directly, but he felt that it was unlikely to be, given the current technologies and the current situation in California, it was unlikely to be a major source of energy in California, which is under a mandate to have a fairly large percentage of alternative energy sources by 2016, I think. His opinion was that... solar is probably going to be the bulk of that because of the timing during the hottest parts of the day and the more consistent than wind energy. And his statement was related to the ocean and wind energy is that the state of California has been moving to far stricter standards in habitat protection and ocean resource protection than historically, such as with wind through cooling here, which they're scheduled to try and remove also by 2016 statewide, so that it was unlikely... to see, his feeling was it was unlikely that we would see installations like this unless they had zero impact on the marine environment. So that given, I'd say you could do nothing. You could recommend to the city council that we write a letter to FERC and ask, show our interest and ask for more information and probably CC the county and the state of California. I also suggested in your staff report perhaps you could form an ad hoc subcommittee that made up of a couple of you, an ad hoc meaning with this one subject, and I don't believe you'd have to worry. You could meet fairly quickly and maybe check into some more information and decide if there might be a better course or look into this intervener status. But that's going to take a little more research if you have a couple members who are particularly interested in that.
Well, that's. Is there anyone on the board who has an interest in this topic that would want to join me in looking into the issue a little more completely? Gene? Okay. Anyone else? Well, we'll okay. Let's the two of us at least, with maybe Ed also. As a third person, we'll form the ad hoc committee and try to get to garner some more information as to this particular project and what the options are for the city and that sort of thing. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, and I'll assist you with that if you would like, and we hopefully could jointly write another staff report to the board at your next meeting that would probably include a specific recommendation to the city council.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Do we need a...
It might be good to pass a motion to form the ad hoc committee.
Okay. Can we have a motion to create the ad hoc committee with myself, Ed, and Gene as its members?
I'll make the motion in a second.
Okay. Ed moves, and I guess I can second.
I also received just today, and this relates, of course, to the Central Coast Salmon Enhancement discussion. I might read this real quickly. I just got this press release from Mrs. Capps' office. Today, Congresswoman Capps, this is dated May 1, Congresswoman Capps welcomed the U.S. Commerce Department's decision to issue a full fishery failure disaster declaration excuse me, for the West Coast salmon fishery, which will be devastated by the recent decision to close commercial and recreation salmon fishing this season. Issuing a full fisheries failure disaster declaration allows the federal government to provide direct financial assistance to the fishermen. So that's news as of today. And I think that's good news. It's given all the other background of problems that caused there. At least there will be some disaster assistance for commercial fishermen and commercial fishing businesses. Back to the staff status report here. There's this weekend is the car show. Rock Cod opened up again today. There's a lot of boats at the boat launch ramp, I'm told. And I expect that we'll see quite a few. The boat launch ramp will be busy again, which is nice. Okay, I want to make a real point to this. We gave you the wrong date for the city budget hearing and the time. Sorry about that. I gave you a memo, but I want to emphasize that the city's budget hearing is next Thursday, beginning at 6 o'clock. So that's next Thursday, May 8th, beginning at 6 o'clock. I do have, it just got released today. I did make a couple of quick copies. I had intended to include this on as an agenda item for you, but we did not have the budget in time because of the early, it's fairly unusual for us to have. The timing just didn't work out, so we needed to wait until the council had the budget before I could put it in my agenda item. So we will put this on as June. I would recommend that we put this on as an agenda item to review the Harbor Department budget in June. If you have an opportunity to watch or even attend the May 8th budget hearings, I think that's a great idea, the city council budget hearings. Yes, sir.
What's the format on those meetings, Rick? How does it work? I mean, is there an audience? And then who's on? Is there a...
So it's a city council workshop type format, and it does vary some years, but I would expect that the city council will hear presentations from the city manager and the finance director on the overall city budget. There probably will be an opportunity to look at individual department budgets and then and other special fund and enterprise fund budgets. And after that, you never quite know exactly what's going to happen. We'll see. At this time, there's a second budget hearing scheduled for May 15th, and tentatively, the city, the budget could be approved at the end of May or in June if it's the action is reviewed and action is concluded by council in these budget hearings. Okay. And there is, there's audience. It's the start of the meeting is usually typical with a city council meeting. I think they'll take public comment, and there will be audience members there. The Peace Officers Memorials, this is a nice event that is hasn't been in Morro Bay in a number of years. It's scheduled for May 14th, 2018. That's a Wednesday. It will be a service at 10 o'clock at the Rock. The public is welcome. And we'll be involved along with the Coast Guard. It would be a nice event memorializing those peace officers who have lost their lives in the year previous. That's countywide peace officers attending and many other emergency services throughout the county. May 17th is the Mermaid and Pirate Parade. That'll be held in, from the Morro Rock to Dockside 2, and that begins at 10:30, but I think check-in is at 9:30. Anyone interested with their children or however you'd like to participate in the Mermaid and Pirates Parade, call the Chamber of Commerce at 772-4467. I can tell from the look on Ed's face that he's going to be participating. June 7, 2008 is the Morro Bay Music Festival. July 4th, of course, is coming up before too long. We'll give you more information on the June meeting. And they did. The council did authorize the master fee schedule with the increases that, as you recommended to City Council, which was 6% roughly for the commercial fishermen, a slightly reduced for commercial fishing slip rates, and all the rest were a CPI of approximately 12%. That'll take effect July 1. Yes, sir.
The article that was in the paper regarding what you talked about the new replacement of the harbor department, have you brought that up before City Council yet, or is that just going to be a line item in your budget that you're going to ask for? Where do you stand right now on that, if I may ask?
It's being recommended for an additional $125,000 in funding to the project. There's a remaining about $60,000. So we still don't, if the council were, so that is, that recommendation is, was, is there anything else?
Yeah, how do we clear some of them derelict boats off the pier here? That's what I like to.
I've been hearing quite a bit of that lately, and, you know, I hope I've been trying to stress to you that we are working pretty hard on removing derelict vessels, and we, you know, we've gotten rid of quite a few, but they seem to come in faster than we can get rid of them. So the staging area tends to be either the buoy barge out at the Coleman or Mother's Beach or Coleman Beach or onto the T-piers where we can closely supervise them and where they can have electricity and availability of pumps. It is a problem coast-wide now. I can tell you that not only is derelict vessels becoming a much worse problem, especially in fishing harbors, but fee collection is becoming a real difficult situation in many fishing harbors.
Just like the mortgage industry, just drop off the keys and here you go.
That's essentially what's going on.
Thank you, Rick. So we have, are there any other suggestions other than those Rick stated for June agenda items?
Just to maybe an update in the back bay in the marina. Just, you know, informational.
More on the State Park Marina again?
Well, I mean,
you would like, okay. Well,
just an update. I mean, nothing. Okay. I mean, you know you're.
Okay, sounds good.
So we keep it working.
I agree. Sounds good. Well, I may not add as an agenda item. If we don't get it as an agenda item, we'll give you a report on it.
Okay. There was, speaking of the back bay, there was something I was sent, I guess, in an email from Anchor Environmental.
Yeah, we've engaged them. We talked about this at the last, was the last meeting, right, when we had our presentation from RM on the State Park Marina in the office. And you know, it becomes obvious that the upland disposal of the material out of the State Park Marina is economically unfeasible and an environmental nightmare, too, with the truck trips and the handling and everything else. So as we discussed, I think we need to use the nearshore disposal site and beneficially reuse the material in the ocean. And we need to have aquatic disposal. The problem is the guidance from EPA says it has to be at least 70% sand, which our material for the most part is not. This firm, Anchor Environmental, we've engaged now has real expertise. They're both ex-core regulatory folks, and they've already made some real good progress for us in trying to see if we can come up with a way in working with EPA to get the bulk of the material, maybe even all of it, in aquatic disposal. So, you know, that's the number that we threw out, I think, was $24 million or something for upland disposal. It's not feasible. We need to get the aquatic disposal or the project will never happen, and so that's why I probably CC'd you on one of the emails about Anchor Environmental.
Maybe then if there is an item in June on the state park, maybe we could maybe you could add this to the packet and provide a little bit more discussion of what they're intending to do. Pardon me.
Sure.
Anything else?
Second.
Okay, is there a motion to adjourn?
We adjourn.
Moved and seconded to adjourn. All those in favor?
Aye.
We're adjourned.